session number 30292, Rule 2.
The same as film stars used to go to the south of France, and of course they couldn't do this in the war, so they came to the Corniche Riviera. And this girl's aunt worked in the post office, and the post office always seemed to know who was coming. I don't quite know why. I don't know how they knew. They tapped the phones or something. But anyway, this girl said, "Oh, Laurence, Olivia, and Vivian Lee are coming to the ferryboat inn and Hereford Passage." And we'd been before. We'd been to the Falmouth Hotel to see Anne Eagle and can't remember who else. And so we were getting practice in talking to famous people, and we cycled out from Falmouth and just walked into the hotel, and Laurence, Olivia, Vivian Lee here, and the reception said yes, and could we see them? Yes, no problem. And they appeared, and they were extremely nice to us, and gave them some bits of paper, and they wrote their names down, and we had a little conversation, and then they went outside to go in the rowing boat, and to our complete amazement, and said, "Would you like to come rowing with us?" But we were just absolutely stunned. We couldn't move to get to the boat. So, but anyway, that's an experience I shall never forget, and I wish we'd gone. If they really meant it, it might have just been a joke, of course. But if we'd said yes and really gone, now that would have been quite something, wouldn't it?
Absolutely, yes.
Well, nobody had
yes.
a camera. So that would be still just fixed in my memory and what I wrote down in my diary. So I know it's true. I never told it lies. I may have exaggerated things, but I never told it any lies.
And what year would this have been, do you think?
I would have to look it up. I was about 15 or 16, middle of the war sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And there were other autographs in your autograph book. How did you meet all these other people?
Well, Anne Neagle was in the Falmouth Hotel, which was the biggest hotel in Falmouth, and Herbert Wilcox. And Anton Warbrook, who wasn't all that nice, but he was in La Ronde, and he was in the Red Shoes, I think, too. And he was gay, or pansy boy, as he was then. He wasn't very nice to us. When we asked for the autograph, he just turned to the people sitting there in the foyer and said, "Look what I have to put up with."
Oh, dear.
He was the only one who wasn't nice. And I brought a new friend then who was very diffident about going anywhere, and I said, "Oh, no, it's all right, they're all very nice." And she just met the one who wasn't. But it didn't deter us.
And was there quite a lot of theatre going on in Falmouth? Was there quite a lot of... The theatre in Falmouth, was it quite active?
There wasn't one.
Oh, I see.
Oh, no,
so
no,
they
there
just
wasn't
went.
A thing. Only a company called the Prince's Pavilion were amateurish. It's a cinema. There were three cinemas, or if not four.
Right, okay.
That was our main form of entertainment, the cinema.
And so what brought these stars down to the area was simply...
It was just a holiday for them,
a holiday place.
Because Cornwall was the place for holidays, wasn't it? Mm. People couldn't go further afield in the war. They did seem to come to Cornwall.
Mm-hmm.
I particularly remember those. And of course, there quite a lot of people... Lafayette Di Moria lived in... that's right, she lived in Foyer, Rebecca. And I'd seen Rebecca... the film, even
yes.
if I hadn't read the book, and we went and got her autograph, and also Quilla Coote, whom I don't suppose you've heard of, have you? Heard of Quilla
Coote? No.
And Howard Spring lived there, and I was just as interested in authors as I was in film stars.
Were you quite a reader?
Yes, definitely. Although, before that, I didn't read a lot, because when I was in Vienna, it took me a long time to read, because I found, when I was quite young, that books took me over completely. I couldn't handle it. And if I read a book that really moved me very much, I just didn't want to read another one for a long time. It took me over. There's no other way I can express it. They haunted me. I wanted to live in the story, and yet I didn't. And it just dominated my life so much that I just couldn't handle it. And that, I think, is my explanation why I didn't read a lot until I was... I don't know, 12, 13, something like that, when I could handle it, this other world as it was to me, more easily.
So you had almost like an overactive imagination, perhaps?
Possibly.
Or you were very
possibly
sensitive to stories? And
I suppose so. I overreacted to the stories, yes, I suppose so. I've never sort of met anybody who felt like that about it. My sister was a great reader, and she could read and finish the book, and that was it, and it was over, and it was only a book, but it wasn't only a story to me. It was another life that existed somewhere, and I couldn't get into it, and yet it wouldn't leave me. So that's my explanation why I did come to reading really a lot, and I think I'm still paying for that I perhaps haven't got such a good background in children's reading as I should have done, but we switched over anyway then to English books. And
well, where did you get the books from? Did you go to a library, or was there a library in the school?
The library, yes, and English was my best subject at school anyway.
So it was the school library?
No, the public library.
The public library.
I wanted to work in a library. A sort of love-hate relationship with stories, really, because of the way they took me over and managed my life more than I could handle it, and yet I just loved it.
So do you remember your first visit to Falmouth Library?
I remember that library, Variant Lane, was called Mr. Hooper, and yes, it was lovely. All the books were bound, weren't they, with them in leather in those days, as they were later on in the Oxford Library. And, oh yes, it's, you could borrow a book. I wasn't a fast reader, and I didn't read a lot, but every book I read, I was just living in it.
Can you remember what authors you read?
Oh, well, I read Howard Spring, Hugh Walpole, not names you know at all.
I know Hugh Walpole, yes.
Gosh, and I remember reading Romeo and Juliet, because just on my own. And who else? Of course, a lot of it was school literature, poetry, I loved. And I can't imagine Hardy. I mean, I don't know if that is people to read at that age, whether they read Hardy and Conrad and, who else did we read? But at school, some of the books were. Because we had a very good English teacher, and she went through it with us. Maybe that made it a bit easier for me when she discussed it with me. Otherwise, you're so alone when you read a book on your own. You're so alone with the characters, aren't you?
Sure. Did she encourage you particularly, your English
not
teacher?
Not particularly. I just gravitated towards that. But that was my world. And Anne of Green Gables, of course. I still, when I see them, I only got to see the titles and I started burst into tears on television. I know that was one of your favourites.
Yes, I know Anne of Green Gables, yes.
And Little Women and... Everything really, and of course Jane Eyre and Charlotte Bronte, and I don't know, because...
And the diary that you were keeping, was that completely private, or did people know that you were keeping a diary? It was completely private?
Yes, I think people didn't know that I kept a diary, because I know a boy stole it once. And took it away, but just for fun. It was supposed to be fun, but I didn't really want... I didn't want anybody to read it, sort of thing, But I got it back again. Yes, they did know, because I was often went upstairs on my own and wrote it all down before I forgot it, sort of thing. Only on scraps of paper.
And how did you assemble it all together then, if you were keeping it on scraps of paper?
It was in a blue folder, which I gave a name, or some kind of a secret name, and tied with a ribbon, and it got fatter and fatter. And it stayed like that until I sort of started editing them. I just thought most people wrote everything down, because otherwise how would they remember? And I felt life was not only for living, it was for remembering.
Yes, yes.
Otherwise it disappears. Nobody knows it's happened.
So then let's go to the end of your school days. When did you leave the school?
Oh, when I was a year older than other people, because I joined a year later, you see. And 17. I was 17.
And what happened to you then?
I wanted to stay on in Falmouth because I loved it, but my father said, no, there's no future there for young people. And anyway, he thought it was a bit Philistine, and I ought to meet people in bigger towns and so on. But he didn't want me in London because of the Blitz, and he was there, and my sister was there, and he said, so I went to Oxford because I had a sort of uncle there, and that's what I did. But I didn't go to university, but I couldn't have afforded it anyway. I just wanted to work in a library, and... So I worked in the library in Oxford. He was not a proper uncle, but he was a relation, and they just kept an eye on me, and I was just boarded out in somebody's house.
And so how did you find Oxford? Was that a pleasant time? Was that a good time for you?
Well, again, it was hard to... Every new life is hard, really, isn't it, when you're young and on your own. But it was quite hard at first, yes, but not bad at making friends, and you know, sort of. I lived in a bed sitting room for quite a long time when I really shouldn't have done, and I was much too young to live in a bed sitting room.
So you were just 17, really?
Well, 18 actually, because 18. The family split up, and there were a family who kept boarders too that his uncle had found, and then when they split up, I went to live in a bed sitting room, and which I did for the next, I don't know, 5 or 6 years, and I was too young really to do that. I suppose people do that now if they're at university.
Well, it's quite young to stand on your own feet and look after yourself.
I didn't have any home at all. I think it would have been lovely to have gone abroad for a year after the war ended, and you know, because I was interested in languages. But I always thought, well, what will happen to all my things? I haven't got any sort of home where I can leave all my beloved possessions, and I would have had to give up the room. And, you know, these practical things sort of got in the way, really.
And making a home must have been an important thing to you at that age.
Very much. I didn't ever have a home, really, until I... But I did move into a flat with my sister in Oxford at some point, but we didn't have a home until we got married. We didn't have any home at all. And I was aware of that, because all my friends had parents, and it was fine while you were with friends, but then you got home into a bed sitting room, and the radio again was my best friend, I remember.
And which library were you working in?
The public library.
The public library.
Yes.
And were they good to you there? Did you?
No, there was a horrible librarian there. No, that wasn't. I stayed there for a year, and then I went to work in a library of a correspondence college, and that was very nice. But you sort of, you know, wherever there was possibility of earning more and, you know, getting promotion. So the public library, and then this correspondence college library where I was in charge of all the books. And then I worked in Blackwell's, which you know, don't you?
Yes, of course.
It was a branch of Blackwell's. It was Parker's at Oxford. And I was there for a few years, and then the best job of all was when I worked for Rosenthal's, but by that time I was about, I don't know, 21 or 2 or something. I worked for an antiquarian bookseller in Oxford, and that was really nice. That was a lovely job, very interesting. Again, I met very interesting people there. I didn't bother with autographs anymore at that stage, but do you know Oxford at all?
Yes.
Turtle Street, you know, Rosenthal's.
I don't know Rosenthal's, no.
It was a very erudite old chap. He was a Sanskrit scholar, and the other one was a musician, and they ran this antiquarian bookseller, and I got made friends with them all. The cousin invited me to Italy, and my best friend working there was the sister-in-law of Stephen Spender. She was my friend, for she was much older, and lots of famous people came. I remember Yehudi Menuhin I was introduced to, and Leopold Sokowski, and I mean, that just happened in Oxford. In Sheffield, people can't understand that you've ever met anybody like that, but that's where they all were. And Rebecca West came in, and the Opies, do you remember the Opies?
Yes,
Opie,
the
children's folklore, they
that's
came
right,
in.
The law and language of
I've got their book
school children, yes.
They did come to Sheffield to give a talk once, and you know, and very, and Cecil Roth was a Jewish historian, and really, it was just what I liked. I enjoyed that. I enjoyed meeting all these different people. But I was able to. I never really learned much about antiquarian books. I think I just, you know, that they were all in different languages, and but I was secretary, and I did take letters down in different languages, you know, German and French, and even Spanish sometimes. So it's a very interesting job. That was the best job I had.
And being a university town, were there lectures and things that you could go to? Were the public allowed to go to things there?
Yes.
What sort of things did you go to?
Yes, well, mostly languages and art lectures, and such famous people came in, Deakin and Seton Watson and Trevor Roper. Being a historian,
yes,
you probably...
Of course, yes.
They all came in. And Isaiah Berlin, have you heard of him?
Yes, of course,
Well,
yes.
I worked for him for a time.
Yes.
For only stepping in for somebody who was on holiday, somebody extra. He was fascinating to work for. So I don't regret my stay in Oxford, although I suppose you're always a bit on the periphery if you're not actually at university, but I was close enough of them to enjoy all these things, you know.
Yes. And this would be about what date? This would be
That would have been in the 50s.
In the 50s.
Yes.
So you first went to Oxford...
What was the year before? In 44.
Mm-hmm.
And I remained in Oxford until 63,
Yes. And can you tell me a bit about the end of the war and how you came to realise that your mother had perished in the war?
Well, we never really did. I mean, we didn't find out until years and years later what actually did happen to her. It was a place called in Germany that they set up this in.
Arolsen. The International Tracing Centre at Arolsen.
Yes, they did. And it was they who told me exactly what happened to my mother, but not until much, much later. And when we went back to Vienna for a holiday once, we went there and we saw the plaque outside a Jewish school saying that's where they were lined up in, I think, the 12th transport or something. And my mother and grandmother were among those. That was November 41, I think. And they were, that was literally, I've tried and tried and tried to find out what happened afterwards, but they were just deported to Minsk. We knew they went to Minsk,
mm-hmm.
but we just could not find out. I've tried everywhere. I really haven't given up hope. I still think sometimes I might find out. All we know is that they were lined up there, the Viennese Jews, women, children, whoever was left, and they were sent to Minsk. But whether they ever got, half of them probably didn't get there. Must have been a horrendous journey.
Mm-hmm.
And how the Germans could afford to do this during the war, when they were fighting on all fronts. No wonder they lost the war. They were so busy sending Jews right across the world on trains. And I don't understand how they could. You would have thought they would have lost interest when they were fighting a war.
Mm.
Lost interest in the Jews, wouldn't you? And still they kept on.
It shows that it was a terrible thing that they orchestrated under the cover of war, and that they put a huge amount of effort into it.
Exactly, and money. It must have cost. And I have said to people, why didn't they just take them to the Vienna woods and shoot them? And the answer to that is that the local population wouldn't have liked that.
Mm.
They wouldn't have liked that going. Oh, even they were anti-Semitic, but they wouldn't have wanted that. That's what I've been told. So they sent them right across during the war, halfway across the world, and took only to kill them, not even to work, to do any useful work. But I suppose, I don't know why they didn't kill them in situ, do you? What other explanation?
So that they could do it where in countries where they had a tighter control and there wouldn't be a public outcry.
That's why they established. But why would there have been a public outcry when they were supposed to be so anti-Semitic, the population?
I suppose. Maybe there had been, it was that much further west, maybe, and maybe there were closer links to places like Switzerland where there was, it was somehow more visible, I would guess. Vienna and Berlin, just slightly more under international scrutiny than.
But to Minsk, can you imagine? I mean, how many miles from Vienna is Minsk? I mean, it's just unbelievable.
A very long way.
Mm. And some of them did get there, I think, and were shot as soon as they got there.
Mm. Yes.
I could have understood it if they put them, made them work, those who were able.
Mm.
There must have been loads of things they could have done in the war. But they're just shooting of so much of their own population. Not shooting or killing or.
And when did you discover this? This was when you visited Vienna. Do you know what year that was?
Well, I couldn't. I would have to look it up. Well, maybe you saw that plaque, you mean?
Mm.
Well, that would only have been about 12 years ago or something like that, 15, possibly. Yes. We found where it was, and somebody must have told us. But that I'd have that black and white, the date they were transported.
And then the
names, Aronson, yes. I forget what town they're in. Is that the name of what?
I think Arolsen is a town. Yes,
right. Yeah,
yes,
I don't even know
yes.
In what part of Germany?
It's in Germany. I'm afraid I'm not quite sure which part of it.
No, I'm not either, but they were very helpful as far as they could be.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. But before that, we tried the Red Cross, and even here in Sheffield, I remember pursuing it. There's no records. That's no records of it.
And so, once you got this information, then this would have been in about what year, then, in about 19...
When we first knew about the transport, I suppose, I don't know, 20 years ago, perhaps, I don't know, perhaps more. It didn't make any difference. I mean, I think I'd done all my mourning.
Sure, yes, yes.
It's just a wound, and you don't... Certain things trigger it off, but... Could be a piece of music or something completely unrelated to it, but otherwise you just learn to live with it.
Mm. And going back to Vienna is something you've done. Tell me about your relationship with Vienna now as a city. How do you feel?
I'm neither a tourist nor a native. I don't know what they make of me. And the first year we went to Austria, they talked to the shopkeepers and they didn't know what to make of us. They said, you speak very good German, but it's very quaint. They didn't know. Did they really not know? They didn't know what we were doing there or who we were. So. And even now people don't understand, really, you know. Even now I get asked, why did you come over? Honestly, I really do.
That's extraordinary.
I said to... That was a hairdresser, I think. I said, where's your history? Don't you know any history at all? I can see that now. I didn't before. I would have thought that everybody would know now.
But do you find, going back there now, that you see some attempts at memorialisation, at recording places where Jews lived before the war in Vienna? Is that starting to happen at all?
Showing remorse, you
mean? Well, simply recording the fact that people lived in particular houses. I know that that's happening in Germany.
Stepping stones, that's right.
Yes.
No, that hasn't happened.
It hasn't happened in Vienna.
That was some years ago. I went back to the flat, and I had some friends with me, because I didn't have the courage to go on my own, and we went up back to the flat, and I rang the doorbell, and it was a vet lived there, and he just opened it, but that must have been longer ago. I suppose they would react differently now. That was before they started admitting the Austrian, and they opened the door, just a little chink, and I said, I used to live here. Could I possibly see the flat? No, and they shut the door in my face. But there's a funny part of this story, because an aunt of mine had a non-Jewish friend in Vienna who was there throughout the war, who I knew, and this friend was very fond of animals and had a lot of cats and rabbits and dogs and things. And I told her how this vet wouldn't let me in to see the flat. She said, no problem. Next time you come to Vienna, I'll take one of my cats. I'll say the cat is ill, and we'll get in this way. But of course, it's never happened. It's never happened. I probably have been back since, but anyway, it didn't happen. But I thought it was nice of her to make the offer.
Yes, yes. Have you seen the memorial by Rachel Whiteread in Judenplatz?
No, I haven't seen it, but I know about it. Mm. Yes, it's in the second district, isn't it?
I think so, yes. And I know it had a very difficult sort of inceptional birth because there was antagonism to the idea of the memorial.
That's
there,
right.
Sadly, from amongst business people in the area who thought that it would make it rather depressing, I think. And then, of course, they found a medieval synagogue on the very site, and that delayed things further. But then eventually it was opened and inaugurated in the year 2000.
I don't think I have seen that. No, I haven't. I'm sure I haven't seen that. No. What does it look like?
It's a white sort of block that looks like a library of books, but they're all turned inside.
I did see that with Flo Kent.
Did you? Yes, yes.
She took me. Mm-hmm. I did see that. I don't know why I've momentarily forgotten that. Yes, I did see that. Rachel Whiteread,
yes.
But I feel that Vienna has never made it up to me, the way the Germans invited people back and Jews back, and Austria has never really done that. But I think if you belong to a synagogue or something, they asked you back as a group. But I do feel now that I've been a bit, it's made it up a bit to me, because a very nice woman called, so I don't know if it's relevant, Dr.
Yes.
Blumersberger,
yes.
Who's a researcher, mm-hmm. not Jewish, quite a young woman, mm-hmm. in Vienna, and she wrote to me out of the blue. I think it must be because of the diary, because she found me on the internet, and she wrote to me, and she said, she's doing research on women exiles who are librarians. Well, I didn't call myself a librarian, but anyway, I just had a Christmas card from her. We've been in touch ever since, and she actually wrote a paper on me in a learned Viennese journal. Partly from the internet, and she was corresponding with me, and I had to tell her everything, rather like I'm talking to you now, but not in such detail. And it's all in German, which you don't read, I suppose.
I'm afraid not.
But I'm so proud of this that somebody. I said, why do you want to write a paper on somebody who's totally unknown and insignificant? And she said, that's what interests me. Mm. I'm not interested in people who are well known.
Yes.
And it's amazing. So I thought Vienna has done something to compensate for.
What did you make of her line of inquiry that she was looking at people who'd left Vienna and worked as librarians?
Yes,
and it's quite a narrow.
I put her right. I said, look, I've always worked with books, but I was actually not a professional librarian. But then she found other things. She got interested in the diary, and I'd written a school textbook, and I didn't tell her anything. This internet is amazing, isn't it? She found it all on the internet.
Yeah.
And she used all that. And now the latest is she's going to write. She works in the, I think I told you, she works in the Kunst ist, what's it called? Kunst, Institut für Wissenschaft und Kunst.
Mm.
And it's next door to the Freud Museum, so I know exactly where it is. And she does research on women exiles, partly. And now the new thing she's going to, she's finished that now, she's going to do some work on the women who perished in the Holocaust. And she asked me to help her with that as well, my mother and grandmother.
Mm. How interesting. I'd be interested to find out more about what she wrote, even though it's in German. It would be useful to add to our file of material.
I would have thought that anything in that's not in English is never going to be known in the world, because German is not really a world language. So, but I suppose that's not the thinking behind it. It's just a regional academic magazine, I suppose. Mm-hmm. It isn't only me in it. There's some other women, but different exiles. All women she's interested in, just women.
And finally, could I ask you about the doll that you brought to England that's now gone back to Germany?
Yes.
Can you tell me a little bit about...
temporarily back in Germany.
Temporarily back to Germany,
again,
of course. Yes, she's coming back.
She's
back
better
soon.
Home in England like me.
Yes.
Yes.
So tell me about your memories of when you first were given that doll, if you can remember.
Strangely enough, I can't actually remember being given it, but she's such a little, insignificant little doll, really. I'm really surprised that Leonora picked it, of all the bigger things there, of the bigger items.
Mm-hmm.
But she's so little, you could almost miss her, couldn't you? And she's a lovely, unusual little doll. It's almost as if she was made of, she's like an action man a bit, isn't she?
Yes.
Of, is it like pipe cleaners or something she's made of? I'm not quite sure what she's made of. But she's flexible.
Yes.
And she's got long, long blonde pigtails, which is what I always wanted to have. She looks like a real little Nazi, actually, doesn't she? I suppose those are the only kind of dolls they made in those days. And she was called Trixie, after a girl at school that I admired. And but I really preferred my bigger doll that I gave to my granddaughters. But as I hadn't got it, I didn't offer it to museum. They were still playing with it at the time, but of course now they don't.
Mm-hmm.
But it will end up with you if you like.
We'd very much like it.
It's a baby doll and it's a boy.
And
it was broken and then was repaired by professionals in a doll's hospital in Bath.
Oh, really? Well, that's the sign of a much-loved toy, isn't it, if it goes to a doll's hospital.
Absolutely, yes, yes. I doubt whether there would have been a place like that here. They were just lucky to be living near Bath. But so that's the story of that little doll. I was very surprised when I had a letter to say somebody wanted to actually, you know.
So Trixie went first of all to Berlin, to the Jewish Museum.
To the Museum of Berlin, yes. And then to Bonn.
Yes.
And now you're in Leipzig, you said.
Mm-hmm.
So she'll have been away for about a year, is it?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, is it? Yes, and it's a lovely exhibition, and Leonora showed us over it, and it's really lovely, and there's a big section on the Holocaust. And
the exhibition is about people who left Germany and Austria, exiles from Germany and Austria.
Yes, but there's an awful lot more to see about Jewish history, I think. And I mean, just seeing it once, you really could do with seeing it again. And, you know, so much. You haven't been, have you?
Yes, I've seen the big museum. I haven't seen the exhibition, though, exhibition that your doll is in. So
no.
I just wonder what that was like. Does it take each different families, or how is it arranged?
Yes, there were some lovely things by different families. There was a family who'd made a beautiful book of all their experiences, illustrated. There were some very nice things, and she went round with us and explained everything.